Y empezaremos a las 6:30 exactamente empezaremos la ponencia de la profesora Priscila Bon, titulada La teoría de Ferrater Mora sobre la ética y los derechos de los animales. Hasta la mía.
Te introduces, profesor Priscila Bon Ferrater Mora, who will conclude, close this meeting of today's on the work of Ferrater Mora with a paper called, called The Ethics of José Ferrater Mora and Animal Rights. She has been working at Penn University till last year, and now she is spending her time and her energy to think, of course, over some thoughts she has had for many years, and to protect and defend and fight for animal rights. Please continue. Todos tienen, está una traducción aquí disponible.
As fast as I can, so that you can all leave and get some rest, or whether I should read as slowly as I can, so you can all fall asleep here and get a little rest. Anyhow.
Take the set away. Please.
There's something wrong, I realize, with my title. This is the title I gave Terry Cover, so it's not his fault, it's my fault. But I'm really just taking what you all know is a couple central ideas from Ferrater and applying them to what is generally called animal rights, which is used so frequently in the United States, the expression animal rights, that everybody knows that it's in favor of stopping suffering, but it's also, I mean, Peter Singer was called the father of animal rights, and of course he's a utilitarian and hates that. He doesn't believe in animal rights at all. He believes in a certain kind of treatment. So the notion of the expression animal rights is kind of suspect in my title. And so Ferrater Mora's theory of ethics is also suspect. So the whole title is suspect.
That's a nice way.
The title's no good. Anyhow, this paper is divided into two parts. And in the first part, I try to show that Ferrater Mora's ideas can provide the basis for something like an animal rights view. And I think that, I think this is perfectly clear and that I'm not saying anything very spectacular. And the second part, I try to show that some of the ideas that are controversial among, let's call them animal defenders or animal advocates, that if we apply some ideas of Ferrater's, they would solve the problems. But I'm not absolutely sure that I've made my point as strong as it can be. So Terry is very nice and made it impossible for you to ask questions. So I won't have to defend something that I may not be able to defend. Anyhow, many of the books published in the United States for a course on ethics, textbooks or whatever, will now include a chapter on animal rights. And it's generally accepted that this is an ethical problem, even for those who deny that animals have rights or that they should be given a certain kind of treatment, just as one can talk about the death penalty and be in favor of it or be opposed to it. So animal rights has gained that kind of status in the United States. I don't think that's the case in Spain at all. I'm not sure. I can't talk about the situation here, but that's what I've been told. I believe that for Ferrater, the question concerning our treatment of animals is no less important because it's the same kind of thing as our treatment of defenseless humans or humans that are in unfortunate circumstances. So I think it would fall under his ideas of justice or something. One could argue against my view that José really didn't talk about animals. much in any of his books, and that his ideas are not explicit. And I would have to agree that he didn't certainly devote pages and pages to this question. Nevertheless, if we take the traditional view, which does not give animal rights at all, the traditional view and the still widely held view of many people, and probably of almost everybody in this room, because I saw what all of you ate for lunch, so you are not animal rights persons. You were eating fish and meat and stuff. So I'm not talking to animal rights people here, obviously. We see that these views that most people hold are based on a notion that is unacceptable to fair tare. For the traditional thought holds that there's a sharp dichotomy or a sharp break or a difference in kind, call it whatever you want, between humans and non-humans or between man and animals. Now, let me just say a word about the words I just used, humans and non-humans. You see this frequently in people who write about animal rights because they're trying to emphasize that humans are also animals. So they say human animals and non-human animals, right? I remember once saying in a class of students that we were animals, and one of my students was very, very indignant, raised his hand. I am not an animal. I said, oh, very interesting. You know, what are you? Are you an angel? No, well, then what are you? I am not an animal. But he didn't quite know what he was, right? So, but I think we are human animals. I don't think that's too controversial. Students may not agree. In the past, this dichotomy, this sharp break between humans and non-humans was justified on the often on some specific asset or some specific ability. The humans were said to possess and the animals were said to not to possess or to lack. It was commonly held, for example, that the possession of an immortal soul, for instance, think of Descartes, the use of reason or language, think of many contemporary thinkers, the ability to use tools and so forth, set mankind apart from the animals and showed the superiority of humans. Right? With a possession, whether the possession of a soul, language, reason, or the ability to make and use tools was emphasized, the end result was always exactly the same. There were two different groups. Over here were humans, over here were animals, and when you thought about ethical treatment, animals were excluded. We had no obligations to animals. We only had obligations to fellow human beings. As Kant put it, we had direct obligations to our fellow human beings and only indirect obligations to animals. Now, in the recent past, the development of various sciences, and in particular, since the time of Darwin, really, but particularly more recently, with the development of ethology, which is the study and observation of animal behavior in their natural habitat or their natural setting, rather than in a laboratory or a zoo or something, has led to the discovery that animals often communicate in fairly complex ways. You can think of the whales. You know about all the various kinds of apes. Several different kinds of primates have been taught languages. There's a gorilla. There's many chimpanzees who've been taught sign language and other kinds of language. And there's a great controversy over whether they have a language or not. But it's been shown that they certainly don't have a language in the way in which humans have a language, not a complex language. But perhaps they have some sort of language. They're certainly communicating. And, of course, it depends upon how you define language as to whether they have a language or not. But anyhow, they're communicating in a much more complicated way than we formerly thought. And it's been discovered also that all sorts of animals use tools. Jane Goodall discovered, you know, that the chimpanzees in Gombe would take a stick and break off the branches so that it was a long, sharp stick and stick it into the termite holes and then pull it out. And lick the termites off. So they were using a kind of stick to, she called it fishing for termites. Well, when she wrote that, that was quite interesting for many people. Here were chimpanzees making tools. But since then, and that's, you know, fairly recently, it's been observed that all sorts of animals do all sorts of things that look like they're using tools. mean, even otters will open shellfish with very strong shells by putting a shell on their chest as they're floating on their back and pounding the shellfish against that shell on their chest to open it. So they're using that shell with their balancing as a kind of tool. And then more recently, very recently, it's been found that ravens will actually bend a piece of metal and scoop out of a bottle to get food. So it's not only primates that are using tools, it's animals like otters and birds, and we don't know what else. So what has happened with all these observations is that all the traits that traditionally were used in the past to distinguish humans from animals have been questioned and at the very least weakened. Now, as I said before, nobody is claiming that animals have the kind of language that we have or that they have such a complex language. But they seem to be communicating, and the differences seem to be one of degree rather than one of kind, which of course is exactly what Darwin said. Despite these findings of science, the common beliefs about animals held by most people have not changed. You all haven't changed your eating habits yet, right? The vast majority of people still reject the idea that there's anything immorally improper with using animals for our own benefit, even if they suffer or even if they die. On the other hand, at the same time that most people have not changed their eating habits, there are more and more vegetarians, and the suffering of animals is becoming something that the public is becoming aware of, and the suffering of animals is being publicized and recognized, at least by some people. For instance, in the latest elections, which in most ways in the United States, in my opinion anyhow, were a complete disaster, Republicans all won. Cockfighting was outlawed in the state of Oklahoma, and gestation crates were outlawed in Florida. I don't know if you know what gestation crates are, but they're crates in which they put pigs for a long period of time. The female pig gives birth in that crate and cannot even turn around. And cannot, if the little pigs go out of the crate or something, she can't bring them back. And in fact, often they're bred in those crates, and sometimes they're called rape racks, because the female can't get away from the male, the boar, the male pig. So these have been outlawed in Florida, which is a huge advance for people who are concerned with the well-being of animals, though they're still going to be slaughtered for food. Anyhow, it's not certain that the findings of science that I just mentioned in ethology, etc., have prompted a new ethics for animals, because even earlier in the 19th century and earlier than that, in England, there were people who called on the public for reforms in their treatment of animals, as well as for the protection of children. And in fact, Berg, who was the founder of the Society for the Protection of Animals, was also the founder of the Society for the Protection of Children. Nevertheless, the latter part of the 20th century saw what was either a rebirth of some of these 19th century ideas, or a new ethic. I don't know which it is, and I'm open to suggestion. But there is a new ethic that is sweeping the United States and sweeping Europe and is even reaching places like China, where they're talking about treatment of animals now. And this was, I think, prompted by the huge number of animals that were used in research, medical research. Also, it's huge numbers used in testing consumer products, everything from floor polish to lipstick, and also by the so-called modern factory farms that severely confined large numbers of food animals, which were made possible by recent developments that made it possible to have the animals fed and watered automatically so that you didn't have to pay somebody to do it, which meant that you could crowd them together in a very tiny little space and have them automatically fed, and therefore it was much cheaper. These happenings, I guess, this increase in the use of animals in research and factory farming or intensive farming were really exploded after the Second World War. So they're a development since that time. Before that time, food animals were kind of raised outside. I mean, now something like two-thirds of all the pigs and probably all the chickens in the United States are raised inside, never even see sunshine. whatever. On the other hand, although this started happening after the Second World War, it was not until 1975 that Peter Singer published his book, Animal Liberation, a book in which he revealed the intense cruelty endured by animals in the research laboratories and on factory farms, and argued for a new evaluation of our treatment of animals. It was here that Singer repeated Bentham's famous phrase, "The question is not can they reason, nor can they talk, but can they suffer?" Now, the most important moral principle, according to utilitarianism, is what Bentham called the principle of utility, or what Mill called the greatest happiness principle, and which Mill expressed by saying, "The ultimate end, with reference to and for the sake of which all other things are desirable, is an existence exempt as far as possible from pain and as rich as possible in enjoyments." In other words, happiness is what one seeks, pain is what one avoids, and people like Bentham and Mill think that this is a natural human characteristic and therefore should be the basis for building an ethic. Now, since many animals are capable of experiencing both pleasure and pain, and it's only a few really, let's just call them, only a few, a very few small number of philosophers who deny that, maybe just for the sake of getting published, I don't know. But most ordinary people believe that, you know, if you step on your cat, whether accidentally or on purpose, it hurts, and the cat runs away and cries out and does all the things that a child would do that couldn't talk if you stepped on the child's foot or whatever. The behavior is exactly the same. And so for a thinker like Peter Singer, who is a utilitarian, if we think that animals suffer, and if we think that they can experience pleasure, then their interests have to be included in this general principle of utility. And that the interests, and then Singer will say that the interests of animals and the interests of humans deserve equal consideration. Now, he's very careful to make clear what he means by that. Singer makes two really important points concerning the principle of equal consideration. The first point concerns what we might call the primacy of being sentient, or roughly this ability to experience pleasure or pain. And the principle of equal consideration is based on the idea that, this is a quote, "the capacity for suffering and enjoyment is a prerequisite for having interests at all, a condition that must be satisfied before we can speak of interests in a meaningful way. The capacity for suffering and enjoyment is, however, not only necessary, but also sufficient for us to say that a being has interests, at an absolute minimum, an interest in not suffering. Okay, so what he's saying then is that, in just ordinary English, any being who suffers, their interests have to be considered. I mean, you don't have to consider the interests of a rock, because you kick the rock or you don't kick the rock doesn't know that you're kicking it, and so the rock has no interest in not being kicked or not being moved or not being cut in half. But an animal, at least with a certain brain development, does experience pleasure and pain, therefore has an interest in not being hit or abused or whatever. The second point that Singer makes, which is important in understanding what he means when he's talking about this equality of interest, and a point that's often misunderstood, is that the interests of humans and animals deserve equal consideration, but it should not be understood as asserting that that humans and animals have an equal or identical treatment. He's not saying that. I mean, this is what many people think he's saying, but he's not saying that. I mean, he's not saying that pigs have a right to be educated or pigs have a right to vote or something. A pig is not interested in voting, as far as I know. What he's saying is that certain animals, by their physiological needs or whatever, should be treated in certain ways that involve their interests, so therefore the interest of a chinchilla might be to have some sand so that it can roll in the sand, because you know that chinchillas have more little hairs growing out of whatever hairs grow out of the I guess it's the cell. They have more hairs than any other animal, and their hairs can match. So in the wild, they roll in sand or sandy material, and it their hair from getting matted. If you keep a chinchilla as a companion, you have to give it special chinchilla sand so that it can roll in and keep its hair neat. So a chinchilla has a need for that. If you didn't do it, its hair would get matted and eventually pull and be painful. It would pull the skin. But humans don't have a need to roll in the sand, right? We don't have to do that. Conversely, a chinchilla doesn't have any interest in, you know, coming to the university here. We might. So Peter Singer is not saying that animals and humans deserve equal treatment. He is not saying that. Okay, now, the point that I'm trying to make about Singer and trying to emphasize very strongly his utilitarianism is that his arguments would make no sense if we could show that animals were incapable of suffering. Human and non-human suffering may not be identical, but the differences must involve differences of degree for Singer's arguments to be meaningful. In other words, if human suffering and animal suffering is not identical, at least they can be slightly different, but if they were completely different so that there wasn't such a thing as animal suffering, then he would be making no sense. If there were a complete bifurcation between the suffering or enjoyment of humans and that of animals, Singer could not argue for equal consideration or to say the same thing slightly differently. Singer's call for animal liberation must rest on some degree of similarity between human and non-human sentiency. There must at least be some sort of continuity between humans and non-humans, at least in respect to the ability to experience pleasure and pain. If there were no similarity again between this human pain and animal pain, the utilitarian call for consideration of non-human creatures would make no sense. Okay. It's not only Singer who has called for a reevaluation of our treatment of animals, but several years after the publication of Peter Singer's Animal Liberation, Tom Regan published a book called The Case for Animal Rights, a book in which he too called for a new morality concerning animals. On the other hand, he strongly rejected just as strongly as Singer rejects the notion of rights. And Regan takes as his perspective or as his starting point the notion of rights. And he states in The Case for Animal Rights that the concept of moral rights, as he calls it, differs in important ways from that of legal rights. First, moral rights, if there are any, are universal. This means that if an individual A has such a right, then any other individual like A, in the relevant respects, also has this right. Now, Regan is honest enough to acknowledge that what counts as a relevant respect is controversial. In other words, what kind of similarity there has to be to say that another being has the right. For Regan, the relevant respects that are similar in humans and many non-human animals, though not certainly all of them, are what he calls being the subject of a life. And he goes into detail about what he means by being the subject of a life, but he explains in another place, much more simply, and I think it's enough for us to understand what he's talking about here, to say simply that animals, like humans, are psychological beings with an experiential welfare of their own. In this case, we and they are the same. In this sense, therefore, despite our many differences, we and they are equal. That's what Regan is saying. In other words, he is saying something that because they have a kind of consciousness of their own, it may not be a consciousness identical to ours, but it's similar enough to ours that they are not simply tools of ours, but they are beings who deserve their own way of life, I guess you might call it. They deserve rights. In sum, then, Regan's argument is quite simple, and it goes like this. If humans have rights, then so do many animals, since we both share this characteristic of being the subject of a life. Right? Of course, if you deny that humans have rights, then Singer doesn't have a leg to stand on. So you can see from the little that I've said that both Reagan and Singer call for a change in our treatment of animals. Their arguments are quite different, and they start from quite different positions. Nevertheless, both of their arguments depend on the notion of a continuum or some sort of continuity between animals and man. Some common shared characteristics. Just as Singer's argument would fail to be convincing if one could show that animals are not sentient and thus could not suffer, so Reagan's arguments would lose all force if one asserted that animals do not have the cluster of abilities that he calls being the subject of a life. It is the resemblance between humans and at least some animals that reveal that animals should have rights, according to Reagan. So the point is that although Singer develops his ideas along utilitarian grounds, while Reagan speaks of rights, both notions depend on some notion of similarity, at least in suffering and enjoyment for Singer, and in being the subject of a life for Reagan. Okay, finally I'm getting to my point. Thus, Ferreter Moore's views on the continuum could provide a theoretical basis for these two thinkers, despite the fact that they're coming from such different starting points, and despite the fact that if you read both of them, they both poke fun at each other. Singer pokes fun at Reagan, Reagan pokes fun at Singer, and says utilitarianism is awful. So if you read them, it sounds like, although they are both calling for a revolution in our treatment of animals, they're coming from very different arguments. But both depend on what I'm calling is a notion of continuum, and of course, this is a constant throughout Ferreter Moore's philosophical development, and although, and this was discussed a little earlier, there was some talk about changes in his ontology or his epistemology or whatever, he was completely consistent, I think anyhow, in his rejection of the idea of absolutes, which is also his rejection of the idea of sharp breaks. Okay, I don't know whether I should then skip what I did in this paper, and I suppose you have all the Spanish translation, and maybe for the sake of briefness I should skip it. I just tried to prove my point, and I collected a number of quotations from starting with Being and Death to where Ferreter talks about the continuum. Should I read all that? I mean, you all know it, I suppose. So I don't have to do that. Okay, so he does it in Being and Death. He talks about if he talked about why it was called Being and Death, and said if you talk about cessation instead of death, that you would be breaking the continuity, and you would have two different and mutually exclusive realms, like the inorganic and the organic, or something, and this would be an error. And constantly, whatever he's talking about, whether he's talking about actually talking about morality, as he does in From Matter to Reason or whatever, he emphasizes this notion of continuity, which I'm not going to belabor since you all know it. Okay. So my claim then has been that one may reject or accept Reagan's arguments or Peter Singer's arguments, but in neither case are their arguments complete without some sort of basic founding ideas or notions that have to do with continuity, and neither of them supply that. So that you have to supply some sort, I think anyhow, if you want to be a systematic thinker, some sort of notion that makes sense of the continuity, at least between humans and animals, to show what either of those two thinkers want to show. Okay. Then the second part of the paper, which is the more controversial part, I'm afraid, where I try to show that Ferreter's ideas not only provide us with a theoretical basis for a theory of equal consideration or a theory of animal rights, but that his system of integrationism allows us to clarify some of the problems that arise from different thinkers like Tom Reagan and Peter Singer. Now, part of my problem with this is that I had published an article 5 or 6 years ago saying exactly the opposite. And I thought I was correct in what I was saying. Now I'm reversing myself. And now I'm wondering whether I really want to reverse myself. I'm having ambivalent feelings about what I'm think. Plus, Terry told me that, maybe my conclusions were suspect. And he's made me think about it. Anyhow, so I'll tell you what I'm doing, and you'll see whether they're suspect or not. Okay. For Reagan, the notion of rights is what he calls categorically abolitionist. In a little pamphlet published by his foundation, the Culture and Animals Foundation, Reagan succinctly explains his views on abolition. After asserting that animals do not exist to serve us, Reagan states, once this truth is acknowledged, it's easy to understand why the philosophy of animal rights is uncompromising in its response to each and every injustice other animals are made to suffer. It is not larger, cleaner cages that justice demands in the case of animals used in science, for example, but empty cages. Not traditional animal agriculture, but a complete end to all commerce in the flesh of dead animals. Not more humane hunting and trapping, but the total eradication of these barbarous practices. For when an injustice is absolute, one must oppose it absolutely. It was not reform slavery that justice demanded, not reform child labor, not reform subjugation of women. In each of these cases, abolition was the only moral answer. Merely to reform absolute injustice is to prolong injustice. That's Reagan's point. Now, while Singer calls for many of the same changes that Reagan does, I mean, both call for vegetarianism, for example, Singer does so for very different reasons, as I've explained, and Singer says very plainly that he calls for vegetarianism because he believes it's not possible to kill the huge number of animals necessary to supply Americans or Europeans with meat without intense animal suffering. But as he clearly notes, the changes that he argues for flow from the principle of minimizing suffering. So for Singer, at least, if you could raise animals and kill them painlessly, if you raise them so that they had a pleasant life and you could kill them painlessly, then he would not call for vegetarianism. But Reagan still would say, well, that doesn't eradicate the problem. The problem is they have a right to be their own beings. They're not our property. We can't just use them. So there's a basic disagreement there, although in terms of what they're actually calling for, they're both calling for vegetarianism, but with these differences. Okay, so these different points of departure have led to different conclusions how we should treat animals, and a lawyer named Gary Francione, who established the first animal rights law clinic in the United States, which unfortunately now doesn't exist, wrote a book called Rain Without Thunder, and he made a couple of distinctions which are kind of interesting. He talks about what he calls the classical welfarists, the new welfarists, and the animal rights rightists, or people who believe in animal rights. The rights position, as Reagan had explained, calls for abolition of all animal exploitation, which according to Francione, the classical welfarist views holds that humans are superior to non-humans, and that the humane use of non-humans by humans is therefore morally acceptable. In other words, what Francione calls the welfarist is that you should seek, in your treatment of animals, you should seek to reduce suffering, but that's all that's really ethically demanded of you. There's no long-term goal apart from this reduction in suffering. Whereas the rightist really says, no, you mustn't do this kind of thing at all. You mustn't slaughter animals for food. You mustn't use them in laboratories, etc. So the classical welfarist does not necessarily seek abolition. Then he talks about what he calls the new welfarists. And he says that they echo the animal rights position in that they reject the notion that animals are a mere means to an end. And they call for an end to animal exploitation. They believe, however, that the way to achieve these ends is by a series of progressive regulations or reforms. They hold that abolition is an all or nothing position, and as such, is counterproductive or utopian. And Francione criticizes this view by saying that it couples rights, the ends of animal right people, with welfare schemes. In other words, he's criticizing very strongly what he calls the new welfarists. The the new welfarists claim that there's no difference between these various positions. In other words, they're rejecting the distinctions that Francione is making and saying there's no differences, or that the differences, if there are any, are not important, whereas Francione insists otherwise. And I thought that I would take the example that Francione himself uses to try to show you what the differences are and to try to see if I can resolve it. The example that's been discussed by philosophers and by legal analysts, including Francione, is a discussion that was first given impetus, as far as I know, in an article in Animals Agenda, which was a magazine devoted to animals, entitled, "Total Victory Like Checkmate Cannot Be Achieved in One Move," and was an article written by Ingrid Newkirk. I don't know if any of you know her, but she's the founder and director of an organization for animals, PETA, which has had a huge success, is quite well known. In discussing the slaughter of food animals, and in particular cows, Newkirk noted that some animal rightists refused to support laws that would require that such cattle be given water. Newkirk states that she could not, quote, "imagine how those vegetarians with clean hands who declined to help could explain their position to the poor cows sitting in the dust with parched throats." Francione mentions her position and also the position of a woman named Karen Davis, who has a PhD and who is founder of an organization called United Poultry Concerns. And Davis has tried to get chickens included in the Humane Slaughter Act, the Slaughter Act in the United States, which states that animals must be unconscious before they're actually slaughtered, and says Francione is making fun of her too, and saying, he quotes her saying, "There's no such thing as humane slaughter, and that humane slaughter is an oxymoron." Well, then why does she want animals to be included, the chickens to be included in it? So the question posed is this: if we pass a slaughterhouse and discover that some of the cows have been left in the heat and the sun for hours without water, should we give them water? Do we have a moral obligation to? Most compassionate people would say yes. I mean, what could it hurt? What could be the problem about wishing to give an animal some water that's suffering from thirst? The next question is, I suppose, should we try to pass regulatory laws that would mandate this act of compassion, or if you want to express it in a negative way, that would eliminate this kind of cruelty which allows these animals to suffer from thirst? Should we try to pass laws that would guarantee, for example, that food animals should not be left without water, even if they are about to be slaughtered? Now this seems, if you're not interested in animals, which maybe most of you are not, this seems like a very peculiar problem. But I think it's a major ethical problem, not necessarily about animals, but it's if you hold a goal or an ideal, should you settle for less, or how much should you compromise, or is compromising a good thing or not a good thing? I think that's what this problem is really about. And if that's what it's about, then it would apply to any ethical question, right? Is a partial solution something that one should work for, hoping to get the whole thing done later on or something like that, hoping to achieve the goal? In other words, if the goal looks impossible, what do you do? Well, you have several choices. You could just completely give up. Or you could say, well, it's either the goal that I achieve or I won't settle for less. Or should you settle for less? Or what would be a compromise that would be, let's say, a good compromise as opposed to not a good compromise, or whatever. So that's, I think, what the problem I'm talking about in terms of giving a thirsty cow water. But I think that that's just an example of this much bigger, I think, ethical problem. Now, Francione believes, as apparently Tom Regan does, though Tom Regan doesn't discuss it in detail, believes that partial reforms will not or cannot lead to abolition. He believes that supplying water to the thirsty cow does nothing to abolish the overall problem of using animals for food. Francione claims that the new welfarist is constantly chasing her own tail. That is, she seeks to, as this is a quote, reduce the suffering of animals that is made possible through a socially sanctioned, institutionalized form of exploitation that allows the sacrifice of every animal interest, no matter how fundamental, to satisfy a human need, no matter how trivial. Right? So he thinks that this kind of partial reform doesn't lead any place. And so the question arises then, does Franz Jung's position mean that we should not give water to the thirsty cow, which seems cruel? I mean, if you see the cow is thirsty, then you can easily give it some water. Why shouldn't you? And Franz Jung answers this question by making a distinction, and it's this distinction that I thought in the past solved the problem, and then now I think it doesn't solve the problem. Anyhow, he made a distinction between what he calls the micro and the macro level. And he claims that one may well have an obligation to give water to the thirsty cow, but this is a personal obligation or an obligation on the micro level, right? And to generalize from this feeling of this individual feeling or subjective feeling of compassion to work for a law on what he would call the macro level, that would pass a law that would require watering cows in a slaughterhouse, is not the proper approach and shouldn't be done. And he says, even if the welfare system recognizes in some limited way the interest an animal has in avoiding pain and suffering, that recognition does not establish any respect for the inherent value of the animal and establish no enforceable limits on what can be done to animals. Okay, so as I said, at one time I thought this solved the problem, but I'm not sure that it does, because I feel uncomfortable with saying the individual has an obligation to do something, but many individuals as a group don't have that same obligation. I mean, making that distinction between the micro and the macro seemed to be a kind of too facile way of getting out of the problem. Now, what Franz Jung does then is to say that he's, and he actually says that these, what he calls these partial reforms, if you tried to pass such a law to water the cow, actually prolong the mistreatment that you're seeking to abolish, actually prolong the let's call it the meat eating of cows, because then everybody thinks that it's humane because you've made a law that cows must be given water, and so there's no movement to stop it. I'm not sure that he's correct, but anyhow. He then, what he says is that he's not opposed to partial change, or what he calls incremental change. So he's saying, he actually says in his book that he doesn't know any animal rights person who believes that these complete changes where you completely stop using animals for medical research or testing household products or, you know, using animals for food, nobody thinks that this is going to happen in one step or it's going to happen immediately. So he says he does believe in incremental change, but he sets up four conditions which would make this incremental change a good thing rather than a bad thing. Right? And the four conditions are these. He says an incremental change must create or must constitute a prohibition of some kind. The prohibited activity must be constitutive of the exploitive institution. Three, the prohibition must recognize and respect a non-institutional animal interest. And four, animal interest cannot be traded. And then he goes on to say that sometimes regulations that look like they're intended to lessen the suffering of animals only enhance the value of the animal as property. And the example he gives is kind of interesting, because before he'd been talking about watering a cow in the slaughterhouse, and then he uses the example of an experimenter in a medical research facility not watering an animal and saying, well, if you don't give the animal water, it's going to get dehydrated and die. And if enough of your experimental animals die, obviously you don't have any experiment. Or a dehydrated animal may not react normally to whatever you're testing, and therefore it's in your interest for your experiment to work, to give the animal water. That has nothing to do with kindness to animals or recognizing the animal as an individual being or anything of the kind. It's for your, it's the animal that's a kind of property, or in this case a research tool, is still a research tool. But it kind of made me uneasy when I read this carefully, because as I said, he started off talking about the problem watering cows in the slaughterhouse, and now he's talking about watering animals in a research lab, and his point may be well taken that you must give water to the animals to have an experiment work, but that wouldn't apply. apply to giving water to this cow, and yet he still doesn't seem to want to do it. I think the key to understanding Francione's position lies in his belief, and I quote, "The basic right not to be treated as property is a right that does not and cannot admit of degrees." And what he wants to say is that abolitionist reform of the kind favored by himself and probably by Peter Singer, probably by Tom Reagan, although it's not absolutely certain, is, he claims, not analogous to any other social reform, because when humans seek to some sort of social reform, let's say, like, miners working for better conditions in the mines, or something of the sort like that, he says it's not the same at all, because at least the miners have certain basic rights. Nobody is rounding them up and cooking them for dinner, or putting them in a laboratory to test things on them. So they're working for an expansion of their rights, whereas what animal rights people are working for is to give the animal some rights at all that doesn't have any, that it, because it's considered property. You own your dog, right? You own the cow that you then slaughter. And so he claims that the only situation, the only human situation which is analogous to the treatment of animals is slavery. And he says only slavery, where humans are considered property, is analogous to the animal situation. And just as the kind treatment of slaves does not abolish the evil of slavery, neither will humane treatment of animals abolish human. Neither will the humane treatment of animals abolish animal exploitation. Okay, so the question that we're left with is what I call these little kindnesses, giving the animal about to be slaughtered water at all. What do we do with that, and what do we say about it? And if we look towards traditional ethical theories, they don't seem to help us at all. Even utilitarianism, which considers animals, won't help us too much, because you could be a utilitarian, I suppose, and still come out against watering the animals, because if you're weighing the advantages to every being concerned, the cow that is thirsty, but also the people who are making money on the cow, it will, and the people who want to eat beef and who want that beef to be cheap, it may well be that a utilitarian would say, okay, it's okay not to give water to the cow. The other traditional ethical theories don't even consider animals. Kant says you don't have direct obligations to animals. I mean, he says you shouldn't be unkind to them, you shouldn't indulge in outright cruelty. But why? Not because it's bad for the animals, but because you might end up treating people like that. So I don't know if Kant would say you have to water the cow or not, but if you know, it's not a very strong argument. Somebody like Rawls talking about social contract theory, well, animals don't indulge in social contracts, so, you know. So my view is that traditional ethical theory doesn't help us at all in solving this problem. And my only ideas were that perhaps Francione is wrong, and that since he believes in education, perhaps if you said that, if you pass a law that you said that animals, that cows suffer when they're thirsty, and therefore you must give them water, that would be a first step on the recognition that cows are sentient creatures. If once you admit that cows are sentient creatures, then if you treat them as property, it looks like you're making a kind of category mistake. In other words, you've admitted this being has feelings of pleasure and pain, and at the same time you're saying, well, it doesn't have any feelings at all, it's just a piece of property like a table or a chair, and therefore I can do what I want. So perhaps we could sneak this thing into Francione's system under his approval of education. But then it occurred to me that perhaps Ferrater's notion of the two poles and using the two poles to learn about something where the two poles represent absolutes that don't actually exist might help us. And I thought if you took one pole as standing for the animal rights view, the absolutist view that animals must be given rights, and you took the other pole as the kind of welfare's view that, well, you should kind of treat them humanely, but you know, you don't have any obligation other than that kind of treatment. And then you took the reform in question, whether it was giving water to the cow or not, you would locate it someplace between these two poles. And if you considered abolition to be your goal, you would, the closer your treatment came to the pole of abolition, the more favorable it would be. What I'm trying to do, and I'm not sure that I'm doing it, is that what Francione says is convincing, I think, when he compares our treatment of animals to slavery and saying that, well, you know, saying that you shouldn't beat your slaves, but the evil of slavery would still exist if it's still legal to own somebody. That seems to be very compelling. On the other hand, his view is too rigid for me, so I'm trying to make it more flexible. And I thought the way of doing this might be using Ferretaire's notion of the poles, and therefore something would fall someplace between these poles. Because the problem is, although Francione says he believes in incremental change, he himself admits that when he gives those four criteria, that it's sometimes hard to tell whether something fulfills those criteria. It's very hard to tell whether the evil that you're fighting is really constitutive of the whole problem or not. I mean, there's all sorts of minor cruelties involved in raising farm animals or whatever. And so it's very hard to tell whether something fits within the 4 points that he mentions. And therefore, if you set up a criterion whereby something is acceptable, and then you don't know whether the criterion applies or not, it doesn't do you much good. That's the problem. And the other problem is that his system is very rigid. So I was trying to get a more flexible way of judging things so that, as I said, locating it between the poles would give us some way of judging what it is that we were trying to do and what it is we were achieving. I'm not sure that it works, but that's what I was trying to do with him. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions? Question in 1 minute is a good question.
Well, I agree with most of what you have said tonight and any other places. But I wonder, and I want just you to answer to a very simple question. If we are to avoid suffering in the world, shouldn't we begin caring about the animals who suffer more deeply?
Shouldn't we what?
Shouldn't we care in the first place for the animals, human or non-human, male or female, that suffer more deeply? And I put an example. I think human females suffer deeply depressions that not human males, or sorry, human animals, males, or animals, males or females, can suffer. I put just the example of depression, because it's a well-known fact that depression is an illness that is padecida.
Suffer.
Well, padecer, you know, the meaning padecer. It's a typical female's illness, and the millions and millions of women suffering depression because of solitude, loneliness, ill-treatment, not only physical ill-treatment, marginalization, ignorance, lack of status, lack of estimation, lack of esteem, etc., etc., etc. So, my question is,
do humans suffer more than animals? Your claim is humans suffer more than animals, so we should start with that.
I have suffered more than any animal.
I doubt it. Animals that are slaughtered in the United States are skinned alive. you still have your skin on you. So
Priscilla, psychological suffering is very, very cruel.
Yes, I'm sure.
And my question is now more and more simple. Do you think a cigala, I don't know the English of a cigala.
I know
cigala. You know
cigala,
splendid. You have eaten cigalas.
Yes.
And your son has eaten cigalas. I remember. I can't remember. You think a cigala suffers very much?
No, let's talk about dogs, not cigalas.
Yes, yes. I think when you talk about animals, you're talking about animals that belong to the our familiar kind, mammifers.
Mammals. Well, I am talking about mammals, but I think I would include birds and fish, though I know less about them and I think maybe less is known. Nobody knows really, I think, whether earthworms and cigalas and clams are sentient. But there's some evidence that earthworms may be. Those are questionable. You know, the boundary between animals that deserve a certain kind of treatment and creatures that are non-human that don't, perhaps, is very loose. I mean, we don't know exactly what animals experience pain. I mean, it was thought at one time that animals didn't experience pain, just as it was thought that newborn babies had two unformed or two immature nervous systems to experience pain. And now the scientists seem to say that newborn babies do experience pain, and they've measured this because of the kinds of cries that they make, and saying, oh yes, they do. So, I mean, actually, I don't know whether anybody else experiences pain. I take you at your word. You say, oh, I have a toothache, and I believe you, but you could be lying.
Yes.
I mean, I can't experience another person's pain.
Yes.
So, it seems to me that when you're talking about animal pain and human pain, it's possible that human pain is worse if you're captured by the enemy and, you know, you're put in prison of some sort and they say we've killed all your family and your country has been conquered and, you know, you're suffering then. So the intellect adds to your suffering. On the other hand, an animal that maybe doesn't have a mind to be able to be told those kinds of things may be more closely tied to his own body. So that physical pain fills his whole universe with suffering. We don't know. So I don't think that you can say, I mean, you can say it, but I don't think there are any real grounds for saying that human suffering is more intense than animal suffering. Maybe the cow who is separated from her calf at birth and who moves for a day is suffering intensely and can't think of anything. I mean, we can think of things to relieve our suffering. Oh, I'll see that person soon again. Or, oh, this dentist is hurting me because, you know, eventually I'm going to have good teeth and preserve my teeth. So the animal can't do that. So therefore, the physical suffering of the animal may be much worse. I don't know. But
even,
I don't think we can.
Even perhaps that, I think that it's extremely difficult to compare suffering even between humans. Even with your people, because I can tell you that I got a depression,
yes.
According to which I suffered more than you.
Yes.
It's very difficult.
Priscilla, just 2 points.
Okay.
I have to discuss this topic with you in Santiago at large. Don't you think that first of all, people who care about animal suffering should investigate the deepness of suffering of animals? The deepness of their psychological, if ever psychological, suffering. And the other sort of suffering that I think is the worst suffering you can ever think of is already, as only human, is the moral suffering, being treated unjustly. I think it was Gary again, we were talking about this Marvel's film, or was Ulysses, I cannot remember, the little savage, el pequeño salvaje, Item 4. And when the wild child...
L'enfant sauvage. L'enfant, not the little. L'enfant sauvage.
Sorry. I don't know French. I'm very sorry. I'm very limited in my language knowledge. But l'enfant sauvage. He supports any sort of suffering. He's punished. And he doesn't react. But when he is unjustly punished, then he comes into a fierce state of mind. Because the moral suffering, I think, is the deepest, hardest suffering. And I think it's something human and non-human.
Well, I think you're entitled to your view, but I don't know that we have any grounds to suppose that that is the worst kind of suffering. I mean, I don't know that physical suffering is worse or less worse than psychological suffering. I haven't suffered physically, but I mean, some people are in intense pain from cancer. I don't know. I mean, I don't know how you measure that. But certainly, if you're punished unjustly...
But Priscilla, I myself have had physical and psychological illness, and I share it. I prefer to have my cat. It's the worst thing, and every woman, and every single human being who has had a deep depression or it's a pain that nobody can understand unless it's or she starts.
Well, but the animal might have that same psychological too when it's isolated.
But
from...
we have to find out, don't you think so?
Well, I don't know. Well, it would be interesting to find out. I don't know how we do it, but it would be interesting, yes.
I'd just like to ask a pragmatic question. How optimistic you are, you are going with relation to the aim of achieving a better treatment for us? You can hear it?
No.
Okay. Can you hear it now? Okay. Just a pragmatic question. How optimistic you are, and which means would you use in order to get a better treatment for animals in general. And another question related to this could be, would you make any difference between animals? Between animals, yes, and between treatment to animals.
You mean between
let's say apes, yes, and cigalas, or...
I mean, I have to draw the line someplace. I mean, if I know that the animal is not sentient, then I think it has no interests. And I'm not sure whether an animal like a lobster or clam or whatever has feelings of pleasure and pain. I just don't know. And it has such a simple nervous system that I can't judge. But once we're talking about animals that are more highly developed, I mean, apparently they know quite well that fish have nerve endings in their mouth, so if you put a hook through their mouth, then it's painful. Now, I don't know, is a fish sad when you put it in an aquarium and it's not accompanied by other fish? I don't know. If you isolate a goat all by herself, she's very unhappy. I mean, you've seen abnormal behavior in that zoos. So I think that, what I would say is what Singer says, different animals have different interests and that you have an obligation to respect their interests. What I think is they are not ours to do with as we please. They are individuals who have lives of their own.
But I think, if I may say something to that, I think that your position, your caution now, in fact destroys the argument, because according to Singer, continuity between non-human animals and human animals is based on the fact of being able to experience pain. If not all animals can experience pain, then there is no continuity. There is continuity just between some animals.
Yes, but us. I mean, people...
But then there is an interruption between some animals and other animals.
Of course. I mean, because people say, who are not right, well, you mean you wouldn't kill a virus? yes, I would kill a virus. Well, is a virus an animal? Well, I don't know if you want to call a virus an animal, but a virus is not something that I think feels pleasure and pain. So if a crab doesn't feel pleasure and pain, I don't mind killing it. I don't eat crabs because I just try to be extra careful, and it might be sentient, so therefore I respect it. But I do draw the line, and the line that I draw is based on whether the thing is sentient.
But then you have living creatures and living and sentient creatures. And this doesn't mean that you interrupt the chain, the continuity, by something which is sentient.
No, because tomatoes and carrots are also living, right? And I don't mind picking them.
Plants, of course.
Well, and the dividing line between plants and animals. So my dividing line is being sent. I mean, when we approach an animal, it's completely vague. I mean, do you mean mosquitoes? You know, do you mean viruses? Do you mean microbes? You know, what do you mean? I mean, Tom Reagan draws the line at what he calls being a subject of a life. I'm drawing it a little closer to the other side.
You see, I think Professor Delicavus, you have made a very, very good question.
Thank you.
That was an extremely good question. And it deserves to be thought deeply, because then, as you said, it's not because they are animals that we must care. I don't mind killing mosquitoes. Nobody does mind. Yeah.
Well, some in India.
Yes,
and
the other point that he made is...
Just a second, Priscilla. When you're thinking of animals, you are amplifying your sympathy, and you are comparing the love you can feel for your soul with the love that a cow can feel for a cow.
I think it's the same. No, I think it's the same.
But you see that, if we have to be rigorous and philosophical, we have to have the study very deeply about the fact.
Okay.
I'm trying to contribute just to this discussion which is evolving now. Well, it seems to me that that you could use or apply the potentialities of Ferrater-Mora's continuum thought a bit more than what you have done. I mean, I agree with you. There is, by the way, it's very strange that people like Singer and Reagan have not used the category of a continuum for dealing with it.
They kind of assume it.
Yeah, but
assuming,
just assuming, but not systematizing.
Right.
So, well, you have probably made the first step. I don't know your article, but I would like to perhaps to urge you to go still further and say, well, we have here in both cases. We have the problem of a continuum in the sense of Ferrater, actually, kind of. But there are two different continua. In Singer's case, what we have is the suffering issue, which also has to be in a gradualistic sense, a continuum sense. And I would say, well, therefore, for Israel, we really need, as the colleague said, much more empirical investigation. For example, our intuition is that certain mammals have a nervous system much more evolved than, let's say, fishes. And for that reason, it's plausible to assume that their capacity for suffering is much more intense.
Right.
So, if in the Singer's issue, in the Singer position, we should develop these arguments in the sense of animal rights, but saying, okay, if suffering is a criterion, then we have a hierarchy,
right.
Probably starting with human suffering, which I really think
sure.
it because of its complexity, probably it's more than that of a chimp, but that of a chimp is more than that of a rat, and that of a rat, and so on. So you see what I mean? Of course, everybody should have his right not to strike in case of...
I'm not sure, because I think the complexity of the human mind may lessen the suffering in many cases.
Well, okay, anyway, it might be an empirical question, which is certainly very complicated. We cannot solve as philosophers, but we can put the issue. I mean, we can tell the biologists and physiologists, look, we have this ethical problem, so help us to discover what the other is. So that would be the single criterion by suffering. The other way, I think that's Regan, because I don't know Regan's position, but that what would the criteria would not be suffering, but rights as individuals.
His criterion really is a kind of consciousness. I mean, that's
a sense of identity, probably something like that, which is independent of suffering. So he's saying, even if the cow does not suffer, he's but we should not keep the cow in some place. So that's another continuum. You see what I mean? So what I'm saying is that it might be helpful to think in this category of continuum of either of suffering or of, personal identity for animals from higher mammals through to worms and microbes. Well,
the problem that I have with Singer, and Regan, one of the problems Regan has with Singer, is that Singer thinks, or he claims, that if you kill an animal painlessly, it's not suffering because it had no plans for the future. Whereas if you kill a human, that means you've stopped the human from realizing his potential or fulfilling his plans. But I don't agree with that. I think that killing an animal, it's cutting off its life, whether it actually had a concept of death or plans or something, it's still, its whole physiological being is geared towards continuing. So I think you're doing it wrong. So, I mean, the thing is, Singer talks about suffering, not death, and he doesn't include death, if it's a painless death, as a kind of suffering, where Regan says, no, this is an independent being, and you should let it be in whatever natural way it is. So there is a basic difference between them.
Do you want to go? Yes.
I just had a very brief comment.
Yeah, please.
Two brief comments. First of all, neither the explicit use of a continuum based on evolutionary development, or whatever you want to say, is not used by either Singer or Regan, but it is used by James Rachels in his book Created from Animals.
Right.
So this is one quasi-empirical, quasi-utilitarian. Philosopher who does employ that strategy. The second thing, Priscilla, it seems to me, as you have in the past, one answer to Espinosa in terms of the radical asymmetry between human and non-human animal suffering is to talk about all the ways in which practically certain institutions reinforce at once human and non-human suffering, right? The raising of animals in ranch conditions in marginal agricultural societies that produce beef for McDonald's, but then contribute to the desertification of subsistence lands and so on. And so, I mean, in other words, there's so many of these that where the welfare of animals, if you want to use that term, the welfare of non-human animals are so extreme.
Yeah, I didn't talk about any ecological damage of some of our, that evolves from our intensive farming. I mean, in the United States, our systems are...
The production of animals using antibiotics, which is contributing to the existence of superbugs. Animal rights, that general sense of the word, are also human questions of human.
Well, that's my other thesis, but I didn't have time to develop here, that I think
animal rights and human rights are very closely tied together. Though one of the things that Jose objected to was the language of rights, because he said, why on earth are you talking about rights when there's so many problems with rights? Can't you express your opinions? So I at one point I said, well, I'm just using rights as a shorthand, which is what Singer said. But now I think that he's really correct, and that's why I wrote a paper called My Inherentist Position, and I made up a word saying that the value of animals is inherent, and I tried to avoid the use of words rights, because all somebody has to say is, well, where do these rights come from? And say, well, I'm talking about moral rights, not legal rights. You get entangled. You know, if you cannot use the expression rights, which actually Francione avoids in one of his books too, all the advice of Jose, then you accomplish something. But rights is the term that is commonly
may
used.
May I ask of all of you who have been may I ask a favor? This is a very nice discussion. Why don't you send your paper, your suggestions, one sheet, two sheets, and they will be published in Telos, our journal. Would you please?
What puzzles me is not the implication of the integrationist principle in that case. Because I think that you put on one side those defending animal rights. I would put on the other side those contradicting that. And you are putting welfare people. Oh goodness. That's a nice way to go to the to get the goal you wish to get, because if you put very nicely in on both extremes something which is oriented in one direction, then it's much easier to get the goal.
That's your objection. But I think it's much easier to do what you say, because then you're taking two huge extremes.
No, but then you have the problem that you cannot compromise between welfare and rights, because you don't have both one on one extreme and the other extreme.
Well,
you just have rights, the extreme position, extreme relation. And then what do you
do? Okay, that would work. What I was trying to do is solve one particular problem. Do you give the cow water? And rights, Gary
Francione is a right. That problem, not having welfare on one side and a right on the other, because then it's clear that you will help the cow
in any case. No, it's not, because Francione is a rightist.
I know.
And he says you don't.
I know, but in your position, in your international position, you will help the cow. I see that, because you put on one side right, that's the extreme position, on the other side welfare. You will find the solution in the middle. So you will do something in between both of you. But if you take negation and really protecting or asserting rights, what do you do?
I'm not sure if you take your position that you end up giving the cow water. That's the only thing.
Doing something for you.
I'm not sure.
Of course, because if not,
because France,
because you start already with welfare.
No, I understand your question. I understand that's what it was.
You start very well for the cow.
I'm not sure that not.
And I wish that you start with someone who negates that the cow has to be protected and kept.
The contradiction was that Francione is defending a rights position,
I see your point. But I think that you make your solution a bit easier if you put it that in that version.
I accept my objection. I accept that criticism.
Muy bien. Si no hay más observaciones, yo desearía recordar a los presentes que Peter Singer, que ha sido muy citado aquí, estará presente en la cátedra Ferreter Mora como invitado el próximo mes de junio, en la primera quincena de junio. Le tendremos aquí durante 15 días. O sea que,
hablando de Peter Singer, está invitado en Portugal, en la International Society for Utilitarian Studies, el 11 al 13 de abril, va a estar en Lisboa.
pues primero pasen por Lisboa en abril, pero luego en Lisboa observen 2 días, aquí 15, o sea, aquí, a la hora de elegir, piénsenlo bien, por favor.
No, pero ya déjame la broma, el que lo organiza, que es un despistado, está medio dormido, pero tiene...
realmente muy valiosos, muy fecundos, que se han presentado cosas realmente muy interesantes, ha sido unos momentos de compartir ideas y muy buenos, yo lo juzgo muy positivo, pero esto va a acabar ahora con la publicación en el 2003, no en este 2002, que ya tenemos tiempo, pero en el 2003, de las ponencias que se han presentado aquí, de las comunicaciones que se han dado aquí, si es preciso, un poco retocadas o perfiladas por el hecho mismo de haberlas discutido aquí, ¿verdad?
Y por tanto,
pueden ser hechas un poquito más largas con todas las prevenciones del caso, pero un poquito más largas. Y simplemente decir que me parece que la Cátedra Ferrater Mora ha cumplido, diríamos, un deseo expresado por Priscila desde hace mucho tiempo y por mí mismo de recordar a Ferrater en algún momento determinado importante del 90 aniversario. Nos pareció un momento importante, puesto que la cátedra sigue en pie, va a seguir recordando su obra, trabajando por ella en los próximos años. If you wish to say something, I'm very grateful that you came, and I think that it was a good job what we did.
I think it was very, very interesting, I think, everybody.
And thank you.